Welcome to Unbridled Aloud, a series of conversations with writers sponsored by Unbridled Books. I'm your host, Kay Callison. We're also asking the authors to read a little bit from their books to give you a taste of what we're talking about as we go along. Today, we're talking with Andrea Portes about her debut novel, Hick. Part picaresque, part coming of age, right out of the tradition of Mark Twain, this novel lives in the remarkable wit and voice of 13-year-old Lulie McMullen, who runs away from home, a run-down Nebraska farmhouse, to find herself a sugar daddy in Las Vegas. She's picked up right away by an obsessive scuzzbucket with a violent streak named Eddie Creaser, and is rescued shortly thereafter by an unlikely good witch, Glinda, a fading grifter who turns out to be on the run from Eddie. And things start going from pretty bad to worse shortly thereafter. But Lulie is a survivor, and with a large measure of help from a mountain man libertarian with an aging German shepherd named Carl, she lives to tell the tale, learning along the way that the territory Huck Finn lit out for has pretty much disappeared and been replaced with strip malls. She also learns what all abused kids learn early on. There is no hiding place. You're out there alone, which is a rotten state of affairs. But whether we have a good family or a crappy one, the only place we can find any of that good stuff, shelter, safety, comfort, is within ourselves. And when really bad things happen, we can choose to be a victim or to be a survivor. Like Lulie, a Nebraska native, Andrea Portes graduated with full honors from Bryn Mawr and took the MFA in theater and film from UC San Diego. She lives in Echo Park, California. Here she is, reading the opening passages of Hick, which will give you a clue as to why Lulie might decide to run away from home.
You know why you keep losing? Guess what? You're a fucking loser. If I could grab you out of your seat and make you fly past yourself and set you down in the middle of this red wooden shoebox, you'd be staring at my mama. You can see her now, ruddy-faced and getting a little too loud, some kind of aging Bridget Bardot, 10 years later and 20 pounds past what might have been, sitting there in a yellow tank, pink nails and blonde flip-up hair. And the shoes are the crowning glory, the angel on top of the tinsel tree, yellow plastic mules with a flower etched on the strap, just above her chipped pink toe berries. My mama's littlest toe looks like a shrimp. She's half in the bag and not caring about bra straps showing or big brass laughing or acting slutty. That's my dad there in the corner, hunched over the bar like some kind of beaten question mark. He's staring fixed into a 7 and 7. 7 for give up, 7 for make do. Not much left over. There's no doubt in my mind that if he could dive headfirst into the ice cube clinking, whiskey pool dangling at the end of his fingertips, he would. If you threw Elvis and the Scarecrow in a blender, topped the whole thing off with Seagram 7 and pressed dice, you would make my dad. He's got tar black hair and shoulder blades that cut through his undershirt like clipped wings. He looks like a gray-skinned, skinny rat cowboy, and I would be lying if I didn't say that I am. Maybe sort of kind of keep it secret, in love with him. And you would be too, you would, if you met him before drink number 5 or 6. Just meet him then. Get lost before things get ugly. His name is Nick, but call him Nicholas, like that Russian royal from my yard sale world book, because if anybody in Lancaster County looks like some displaced king, it's my dad, shot 4 through time like a diamond in a dirt box. My mama's name is Tammy, last name Cutter. And the worst part about it is, my dad can't stop being in love with her. Even as she sharpens her knife on the bone sticking out his back, even as she slurs her words, even as she makes goo-goo eyes at strangers, even then, he tilts his glass and shrugs and jingles the change in his pocket and waits for her to love him back. I mean, they never win. They never win. Tom Osborne is just not a winning coach. She lowers her voice to a loud and confidential whisper. I mean, if you ask me, he's just a dud. Just an old dud. He's not hungry enough to win. And then, like she's going to show you what true hunger looks like, She throws her head back, sets down the rest of her Berry Lime cooler, and slams the empty glass on the bar like a drunk German, itching for a fight. If you want to know how to reach us, you can call us here. Let's just say that's your best shot. So here's the number. Just ask for Nick. Let's just say the phone may or may not be working back home. Let's just say next to the line marked O for office, you can just put down the alibi and Bob's your uncle. If you want to track us down on foot, it's that red neon sign 3 miles outside Lincoln, halfway down Highway 34 towards Palmyra. If you get to the water tower, you pass it.
Andrea Portes, reading from her debut novel, Hick. I'm Kay Callison. We join our conversation as I ask Andrea about the house where Luli lives. In Hick, the narrator, Luli, lives in a beat-up farmhouse outside of Lincoln, Nebraska. And I'm wondering, did you live in such a place as a child, and was it bulldozed for a Blockbuster mall or some such?
Yeah, exactly. We used to live in a farmhouse on the outskirts of Lincoln, towards Palmyra. The farmhouse across from the cemetery with the barn and all the stuff faded, exactly as it's described in the book. And we were kicked off so that they could bulldoze it all over and build a Blockbuster mall.
In the acknowledgement to Hick, you thank your brother for his support, saying that most people had written you off as a glorified degenerate. So I was wondering, why would people have thought that about you?
Because basically in the time since I graduated from college, I think that my coterie of ne'er-do-wells could possibly make me look like a glorified degenerate.
Well, where all did you live? What did you do?
Well, I lived in Philadelphia for a year, and then San Diego. I went to graduate school for 3 years, but then lived in L.A. in Echo Park with my group in a house that we called Rancho Malcontento.
Oh.
And I just think that most people pretty much, I think my family included, had pretty much written me off.
Did they know you were trying to write?
I don't really think they knew what I was up to. But the fact is, we had a very funny little Western-style sign above our door that said Rancho Contento. And then somehow that ended up with us calling that house Rancho Malcontento. The very last paragraph of that book was actually written at a birthday party where everyone else, where I was, I had sort of left the party, but the party was still going on around me.
Was it sort of like your own Laurel Canyon?
Well, I actually have lived for like a year in Laurel Canyon, and Laurel Canyon is nothing like Echo Park, because Laurel Canyon is like Diet Coke, and Echo Park is a little bit more like Jim Beam.
Oh, I see.
It's like people don't have their acts together at Echo Park in a kind of wonderful way.
I see. Well, someone else I wanted to ask you about, who you thank in your acknowledgement in Hick, is your mom. You thank your mother for giving you one of those so-called hearts and tell her that if it hadn't been for her, you'd have taken your rightful place as the second female serial killer of all time. Needless to say, I find that very intriguing. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Well, it's funny because my mom now thinks that everyone who meets her is going to think she's some kind of drunk and floozy. But the fact of the matter is, my real mom, my actual mom, is very, very sort of sweet and loving and caring. And unfortunately, when we were growing up, we had a really rough childhood. We moved around all the time. Everything was always, we were always in a new school, always in a new place. And if it weren't for my mom, I think that I probably would have been a horrible, vicious person. Her heart and her goodness and her warmth as a mom is really the thing that saved me. And I didn't really realize that not everyone had a mom like that until I went to college and saw what else was going on with everybody else. And some people's moms were just out to lunch, or some of them were just kind of like dinner party moms. But, you know, I basically hit the jackpot, actually, when it came to mother.
Well, Luli has that insight in the novel when she meets the young man Clement at the Motel 6 and has one of her real epiphanies of realizing that doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, you can still have a screwed up parent or set of parents or family situations.
That is true. And that is something that obviously came to me because when I first was encountering people who came from very, very wealthy background, you know, I just assumed that everything would be perfect. And then as you go on, you find out that people have trauma, people have weird things happen to them. People are abused in strange ways. Some of them are molested, and or some of them are just ignored. But there's a reason why some of those people who you would think would be so happy end up being junkies or alcoholics or whatever.
When did you start writing?
I've always been writing ever since I was a little kid. But I started writing Hicks in a little blue book that someone had given me. It was just a dumb present. It wasn't even a friend that gave it to me. It was kind of like an acquaintance. And then one day I just started writing Hicks, and that was sort of where it came from. Luli, sort of that voice, just kind of kept talking and saying stuff and saying stuff. And finally, I just threw up my hands and said, okay, and just started writing.
It sounds like you're one of the writers who sort of feels like a medium.
Yeah, I don't want to sound weird and mystical, but I do find something strange happens, which is that in the morning, right when I wake up, or at night, or sometimes when I'm going about my day, these voices, these paragraphs, these passages, sometimes an entire chapter, just start talking, just comes into my head. And it's like, I have to grab something. What is it? Sometimes it's the back of another book or something, basically just grab something and start writing. So it's not like, I'm definitely not one of those people that sits down and is like, that can make something come of nothing. Usually it's the thing just starts banging at the door and I have to just kind of start writing it. So I have the weirdest, I've got the backs of receipts with passages. I think I've got the back of bar napkins with passages. It just happens that way. It can be frustrating though, because you'll be sort of just driving around or you'll be doing something and this thing starts talking to you, and you sort of start talking in the voice and you kind of figure it out, and then you write it down to make sure you don't forget it. You know, but it's frustrating, you know, sometimes you don't want to be hearing voices.
Yeah.
I mean, it does make you feel like you're about two clicks down from just being some crazy lady living in a house with 20 cats. You
know? Well, in terms of the genre, how would you describe this novel to someone?
Well, I would definitely say, you know, coming of age, but I would say it's like Paper Moon.
Or Addie Prey, the novel.
Yeah, Addie Prey.
What about Bastard Out of Carolina, Dorothy Allison?
It's very, very influenced by Bastard Out of Carolina, the sense of being abandoned.
Also, it's even got elements of The Wizard of Oz in it.
I'm really glad you noticed that. You know, there's the one backdrop, which is the suburban brawl happening in the Old West getting taken over. And then the other one is this kind of like giant landscape that you see of, you know, what is Americana and The Wizard of Oz and that magical, big, bright world.
Well, we've got the Good Witch Glinda, after all.
Yeah, we do have the Good Witch Glinda.
Into her bubble.
Yeah, she's in her bubble. And, you know, there are things, and in a way, they come to Luli the way that they do come to you as a kid. You know, Elvis Presley and Marlboro Man, and how you look at these things and how they affect you. Oh, I'm looking for my cowboy, my Marlboro Man.
Yes, those are all the cultural artifacts that operate in this novel. And I was going to ask you about the setting of the novel, that the setting of the American West really seems very important in Hick.
Well, it is a love song to the West and to that part of the country and to the Old West. So not the suburban sprawl West, but the, you know, the wide open spaces and all of that and the mystery in that landscape. And I still have so much love for that. But I tried to make a lot of the similes and the kinds of, you know, metaphors having to do with the earth, the land, the sun, the moon, the trees, not the way that you would if, let's say, this were a novel that was set in Echo Park.
How would you characterize the humor in Hick? Because it's very funny.
I would characterize it as good old American humor, the Midwestern humor, the humor of my grandfather who flew in World War II. It's the kind of humor that you have when you're confronted with things that if you weren't humorous about, you would just fall down and die. You have to do something in order to survive, and I think humor is basically a great sort of tool. It's also very American. I mean, one sort of irreverent American wit And my grandfather, who flew in World War II, absolutely has it, and so does my mom.
Andrea Portes talking about her debut novel, Hick. I'm Kay Callison. Before we rejoin our conversation, Andrea asked to read Chapter 2, where Luli tells us about her baby brother, and we get a taste of the kinds of things in their world that if you couldn't laugh about, you'd just fall down and die.
Did you know I have a baby brother? Had one. It's because Tammy had a blue dress. Tammy had a baby blue dress that came down not far enough, and my dad liked her in that blue dress, and then the next thing you know, that blue dress started fitting tighter and tighter around her belly, and next thing you know, it looked like she swallowed a basketball, and next thing you know, my dad was skipping around talking about, Luli, you're going to have a little baby brother now. You're going to have to help your mama now, see? And even though I was only 7 and didn't know why Tammy swallowed a basketball or how that made a baby brother, you couldn't help but smile when you saw my dad floating through the door and through the next, sashaying around Mama in her too tight blue dress. And she'd say, now come on now, you don't know it's going to be a boy. You just don't know that. Just shush. And he'd say, yes, I do. I do sure know. It's like I know the sky is blue and I know the world is round and I know I married the most beautiful girl in the county, the state, the whole wide world, darling, the whole big wide world. And this is the part where he'd sidle up behind her, start rocking back and forth and making her blush and play swat him away. But she's swaying too, swaying there in that baby blue dress too. And they had a Sunday with everyone coming over and bringing gifts and a cake and a little baby crib from Aunt Gina and Uncle Nipper, white with gold trim, like something you pulled out of a dollhouse and blew up life size. And they were laughing and giggling and smiling 30 ways till sundown. And you would have been smiling too, because it was like all the good mornings and all the hi, how are yous and all the well, hello, sunshines in the county had taken us all at once and decided to march down the dirt road in the light just this one Sunday afternoon and arrange themselves in a circle around my basketball swallowing mama, sitting proud and pretty in that blue dress that started it all. And maybe God and the angels took note of that blue dress, too, because when that baby came out the color of moonlight, we all knew something was wrong. And he was a boy, all right. Dad got that part right, but he wasn't the kind of boy you could take out front and throw a football to in 4 years or 5 or even 6. No, sir, he was just born the color coming off the moon and sickly and sniffling and stiff. He was just born with a frown on his face, like he got dropped off at the wrong planet or maybe the angels left out a step or maybe he didn't want nothing to do with it in the first place. And he had to sit in that incubator like some kind of otherworld baby chick while my dad and Aunt Jean and Uncle Nipper just waited and waited and whispered and whispered and spent more and more money they didn't have in the first place just to keep him down on this here planet. And there was a doctor came in from Omaha, and he took one look at that baby and said, we best be bringing him up there because that's where they got the best doctors and the best treatment money can buy. And my dad smiled and nodded and said, oh, yes, doctor. And that baby stayed right there in that incubator for 3 days straight before deciding that maybe this wasn't the place for him after all. Maybe this wasn't the right planet or the right county or the right two-broke family from somewhere out in the sticks anyways. So he just upped and took to floating back up into the blue sky from whence he came. Back up to wherever planet you get to go to when you get born the color of moonlight and your too poor daddy can't afford to send you up to Omaha where they've got the best white-coated smiling doctors that know what the fuck to do anyways. You see, it's one thing to pretend you're James Dean and pump gas in the summer and make the girls blush before heading back to your double wives. It's one thing to pack mules in the fall and live in a log cabin and dip your hat down before riding off into the setting sun. But when not being able to scrape 2 dimes together makes it so your baby boy, born the color of the night sky, has to stay put in that glowing tin cup incubator instead of up with the experts in Omaha, well then, nothing glamorous about that now, is there? And she didn't have to say it, my mama. When the bones fell out her body all at once and Aunt Jean and Uncle Nipper tried to hold her ragdoll body up by the elbows, she didn't have to say it. My mama, when it was like God himself had his heel into her back, holding her head down into the linoleum. She didn't have to say it, my mama, when my dad tried to shush her, sobbing into the child. When she pulled back, recoiled at just even the inkling, the beginning, the thought of his hand on her arm. She didn't have to say it. None of it. We all knew. We all knew. And Uncle Nipper knew to go to the house and get rid of that white crib with gold trim before Mama could set eyes on it. Please, Lord, just do it. And Aunt Gina knew to take that baby blue dress and just bury it deep in the back of her closet far, far away before Sunday visits and swollen basketballs and boys born in the color coming off the moon. And I knew. This is when I first knew. This is when I learned how to throw myself over to the other side of the room and watch my dumb little life like I was watching a movie. And you get the popcorn. We'll set a spell and see what else goes by. And there goes Dad. He's been slumping around for 3 weeks straight with his head hanging off his shoulder. And there goes Mama. She still can't eat, but bring her this macaroni salad just in case. And there goes most of my little kid playmates, because no one wants a fucking thing to do with this house anymore, that's for damn sure. And here comes Aunt Gina and Uncle Nipper with a few kind words and making sure I got at least some Malto meal and Chef Boyardee to tide me over. They'll be back tomorrow. And there goes my baby blue brother, somewhere into the night sky above me. And I wonder if I get to see him someday. And I tell him about the white crib he missed out on. And then I know it wasn't much, but we were real proud to have him. And wanted him to stay. Just wanted him to stay, spouse. And I would have played whatever silly little dumb game he had in mind, really. I was just out of heaven. My baby brother born the color of dusk. And you better just learn to throw yourself 20 feet across the room and let it play. Just let it play. You better just learn to put each day and night up onto that screen and just keep on watching. Here's what you'll see. You get to see the incredible shrinking man. You get to see a man 6 foot tall turn in on himself, slump forward into nothing, and then gone. Poof. You get to see a great tale of revenge and lust with a beautiful blonde with flip-up hair. You get to see her get gussied up each evening and put on lipstick and giggle loud and bat her eyelashes at strangers, straying a little behind the alibi on a Saturday night. No, better, make that Sunday. Hell, she might round off with the devil himself if he walked in. Leaned his elbows on the jukebox and tipped his hat just so. You get to see all these attractions and then some. You get to see Elvis-style dreamboats and flooded-up little girls and eyes swirling wild by the side of the road. You get to see naughty pink parts and coming attractions and wait, just wait, there's more. Keep watching, let it play, let it play.
Andrea Portes, reading from Hick. I'm Kay Callison. Here, I've asked Andrea where Luli gets her compassion for her parents, her ability to see and comprehend Nick and Tammy's pain, despite their being pretty much irredeemable by most reasonable standards.
I think she loves them. I think she really loves them, and I think she loves them the way that a child loves their parents, which is seeking their approval. I think that children look at their parents and they seek their approval and they love them no matter what, no matter how horrible they are. And I think that even though her dad is a complete, well, whatever you want to call it, I don't want to pigeonhole, but even though he is what he is, mm-hmm. she still is in love with him. He's still her dad, her Elvis-style cowboy dreamboat of a dad. And her mom, she just wants her mom to love her.
And to not regret having taken her youth from her.
I think that that's true, though. I think she really feels a tremendous amount of guilt. You know, when she sees her mother, she knows that her mother could have had a better life, or at least she thinks that she could, which she probably could have. And she knows that her mother knows that she married the wrong guy. She hitched her cart to the wrong horse. So she just feels bad that her mom didn't have a better life because she chose to marry her dad and have her. But to me, the most heartbreaking thing is that she still was holding out. She still had this dream that she was going to go off and bring Luli with her and have this wonderful, amazing mm-hmm. life. And when that was taken away, then she was just gone.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the figure of Luli as a neglected child in terms of her behavior when she does run away from home and get out on the road. It's extremely true, this push-pull of vulnerability and at the same time as being a little bit street smart and streetwise. Where did you learn all that stuff?
I know a lot of people, both male and female, who had horrible things, inappropriate things happen to them at stages of their lives where they shouldn't have been happening. And those kinds of things have a lot of different effects. I mean, in some ways they make you more strangely very sort of sexualized early. And then in other ways they make you really just want to erase yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think that the Lulie's coping mechanisms are throwing yourself on the other side of the room. But also, I do think that she, when she first realizes in the beginning that she has, that these somehow these bubbles coming on her body in this shape gives her power, I think she feels like, okay, well, I can do something with this. And I also think she has real feelings. She does see Eddie as this Marlboro Man cowboy figure, and she needs her leading man. So this gets her into a situation where she ends up being hurt.
Well, she's drawn like a bird to a snake to exactly that which is going to lead her right into a car crash.
Well, I think that that's also a result of what she's used to. Someone came up to Lulie that was a normal, nice person that had like a normal thing and was totally, she wouldn't know what to do. I mean, mm-hmm. she would find it completely confusing because her life, that what is normal in her life is upheaval, feeling alienated, you know, just everything being very destructive. So if somewhere were to come up that was perfectly normal and nice, I think she would be out of there.
Mm-hmm. Right. Have you thought about Lulie 5 or 10 years down the road? And if you have, what would you predict or hope for her?
I know that she will be okay. Like, I know she will be probably doing very well, actually. Because she's a survivor. She basically has a survival instinct that a lot of other people are lacking.
And she's going to go from being an observer to being a creator.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I think essentially she always was a creator. Uh-huh. She just didn't, with all of the drama and the sort of destructive, dysfunctional things going on around her, she couldn't. But the fact is, that is her character, her intellectual curiosity, the way she looks at the world. She always was a creator. By the end of the novel, I mean, you could basically put her anywhere and she would be okay. She's not going to let the things that happen to her define her. Mm-hmm. She doesn't see herself as what's done to her. She
right.
sees herself as what she does. Maybe that's naive. Maybe in 10 years I will write a book with a protagonist who just falls and keeps going into the abyss, but I don't think so, because I think that in my mind, that courage in the face of fear and adversity is what I admire.
Andrea Portis, thanks so much for taking time to talk with us today about your debut novel, Hick.
Thank you for talking to me about it.
Andrea Portis, our featured writer today on Unbridled Aloud. This series of podcasts is sponsored by Unbridled Books, who promise you that rarest of pleasures, a good read. Other writers we're talking with include Elise Blackwell, Mark Cunningham, and Timothy Shaffert. For more information about Hick and other titles from Unbridled Books, check out their website at unbridledbooks.com. You'll find all kinds of interesting stuff there, including a long list of literary links and book study guides for most of their titles. This program was produced by Kay Callison for Unbridled Books. For other interviews with authors of fine prose conducted by Kay Callison, also known as Kay Bonetti, go to the American Audio Prose Library website at americanaudioprose.org. The music is by Tom Andes from his solo piano CD, One Voice. You can find it on Amazon.com. For Unbridled Aloud, this is Kay Callison.